Chapter 13, Opportunity Selection and Negotiation. We have covered approaches for preparing your mind for opportunities, for spotting opportunities, and for estimating the value of potential opportunities. Once you find one that looks right, sounds right, feels right, and makes sense, and all of your ways of calculating value line up, then it will be time to actually commit to that opportunity. A moment of decision in life can be one of our most psychologically stressful experiences. The word decide is built from the suffix side, which means to cut off or to kill. It's related to words like pesticide, homicide, and suicide. Not very inspiring. Yet, in the moment of decision, we must cut off other possibilities and potentially kill off other opportunities. If you pay careful attention, stress often accompanies decisions of all types. The mind has to deal with the cognitive dissonance of potentially making a huge mistake or missing a huge opportunity resulting from a different choice. The brain, pound for pound, uses the most energy of any organ in the body. I suspect one of the reasons it uses so much energy is this cost of decision making. I still think about decisions I made in the past where I missed out on big opportunities that were right in front of me. Sometimes they haunt me, but I remember decisions I made that led to accidental opportunity. Each of these possibilities creates a present awareness of what's at stake when it's time to make a decision in life. Somehow, knowing that decisions can be very stressful helps me. It reminds me that when I feel hesitant, nervous, or fearful, or excited, optimistic, or greedy, that this is all normal. It gives me permission to relax a little bit, and allows me to go meta to the situation and look at it from a higher perspective. We're also learning multiple models and methods for finding, creating, appraising, selecting, and acting on opportunities, which adds to the complexity. In this section, we're going to look at mindsets and methods for selecting your best opportunities and doing it in a way that's less stressful and more efficient and natural. Use these tools and models to select the very best opportunities for yourself and your future. Evolution is about adaptation and selection. When people think of evolution, they tend to think of the adaptation side of evolution. Animals moving through a dangerous world, needing to move quickly or be eaten. Nature red in tooth and claw, and all that business. But we forget that evolution is also called natural selection, and that selection doesn't mean only selection pressures, but also being selected by another one of your species in order to mate and reproduce. If you go look around in the animal kingdom, you see a lot of strange things that don't seem to make sense at first glance. You see huge tail feather displays on male peacocks and giant antlers on male deer. Darwin was confused by these exaggerated body parts because they appeared to be counterproductive to the survival of the animals that carried them. But Darwin also gave us a huge insight into what was going on here. In his work, he discussed sexual selection, which again is a big part of the word selection in natural selection. Exaggerated ornamentation is usually observed in males when it exists, and evolutionary scientists tend to agree that it allows females to select the most robust, healthy, and genetically fit mates more easily. If you're carrying around a massive rack of antlers, then you probably have great genes. You lack diseases or parasites and have been able to find enough food to grow them. If you have long tail feathers with lots of eye spots on them, then you have great genes, lack diseases or parasites, and have been able to run and fly faster than the things that want to eat you, even with the extra disadvantage of a few feet of feathers hanging behind you to grab onto. And if females love exaggerated ornaments, then they'll tend to mate with the males who have the most exaggerated ornaments, leading to the theory of runaway feedback loops where the ornament, or the fitness indicator, just keeps extending further and further as females select for it more and more. The point here is that evolution is just as much about choosing and being chosen, sexual selection, as it is about survival and adaptation. You can be born, survive to adulthood, and have a boatload of other positive qualities. But if you are not chosen by a mate, and you don't reproduce, then your genes don't make it into the lottery for immortality, and your genetic line ends there. The stakes are high, and animals do a lot to select and be selected by the best possible mates. The term selection pressures means that you not only have to adapt to your environment, but you also must deal with the pressure that comes from needing to be selected in order to find a mate. And that's serious pressure. In the animal kingdom, biologists have noticed that it's mostly females doing the selecting. Being married and having a daughter has shown me firsthand how powerful a woman's selection power is in real life. I also know a thing or two about this because in a past life, I was the number one dating guru for men, and I discovered that the secret to success with women was to stop acting like you don't deserve to be selected. If you want to be successful at attracting a mate as a man, then you need to attract her. It's a completely revolutionary mindset for most men who have challenges with women, but it can also create a radical shift for a man when it's properly understood. To sum up, selection is a big deal. If you want to succeed in life, you need to select great opportunities, and you need to be selected as a great opportunity. But there's another side to this as well. Many animals and many humans specialize in sending signals that make them appear to be one thing, but they are actually another. Counterfeit ornamentation, fake signals, and convincing camouflage are common in both worlds. An anglerfish has an extension that sticks out of its head, which holds a small bulb at the end. These are actually bioluminescent in most cases, which means they light up in the dark. A small fish swimming at night sees the light, swims toward it, and then has a huge set of teeth devour them from the darkness. Not so fun if you're the prey. And by the way, scientists think that the light lure also serves another function, to attract mates, which is interesting to contemplate. One of my favorite attractions at Burning Man is a giant mobile nightclub that has been built, I think, from a school bus. It is almost entirely covered in psychedelic lighting that creates pulsing waves of complex color patterns. The incredible contraption features a small dance floor that sticks out in front, ahead of the driver, where dancers can step up and dance. From far away, you realize the entire thing is a fish with fins and a tail. If you look closely at the dance floor in the front, there are fake teeth with a giant disco ball hanging there. When it all comes together, you realize that the designers have created a massive anglerfish on wheels. This giant mobile disco drives around Burning Man, stopping to pick up and drop off dancers, luring them to its dance floor with a magical, psychedelically lit disco ball. This is a personal favorite example of selection in action. Curate. In our evolutionary past, we had far fewer options than we have today. If you were hungry, there were no restaurants, grocery stores, or delivery services available. You had to go out looking for something to eat or consume what you stored up previously. Walking into a grocery store full of fresh produce displays more abundance than any historic king could have dreamed. The point is, we now live in a very different reality from the one we were designed for at the animal level. I think it's important to make intentional mindset upgrades when it comes to the moment of selecting an ideal opportunity. This prevents opportunity overload and the making of rash decisions or regrettable mistakes. There's an interesting new word that has been emerging onto the scene in various domains. It's the word curate. I hear more and more people using this word in diverse contexts. Google Trends show that the interest in the word curate is growing dramatically in the past decade as well. What does it mean to curate? Originally, the word meant to care for or be responsible for something. And it also has historic religious overtones, implying caring for souls. To curate is to select certain elements from a wider array, as in an art gallery or a music festival or social event. If you curate an art gallery, you select the pieces of art that will be featured in the gallery. If you curate a social event, you select and invite the people who will be attending. Curation implies taking responsibility for the overall production and seeking out and selecting those elements that contribute to the best experience for everyone involved. It also implies creating a setting or a mood aligned with a particular aesthetic. I think that the explosion of options in the world contributes to the rise of the use of this word and concept of curation. When you have many options, you don't have to pick just one, and you don't have to limit yourself to what's readily available. You can go search the world for the best, and then from the options you find, select the right combination to create the atmosphere, the tone, and the outcome that you want. I'm a part of a Burning Man camp called Camp Mystic. I curate much of the art we feature in our event space. Others curate the musicians, the live speakers, and the performances. The camp leaders act as meta-curators to coordinate all of these various mini-circuses happening in order to bring it together as a unified, streamlined experience. By the time we have the entire camp set up, it becomes something extremely intentional and special. When you walk into a space that has great lighting, great art, great music, great performances, and great people, it puts you into a certain state of mind that excites and inspires you. Even though it's out in a dusty desert, and much of the setup is improvised from whatever is available, it's clear and obvious that intention goes into making the space welcoming and mind-expanding for everyone who visits. Because I curate much of the art we hang in our camp space, I feel a responsibility to make sure that it's the best. And so each year, I look across what has been produced by all the visionary artists in the previous year, and I select a few new pieces to feature in our gallery. I then add them to the group of already great pieces and keep building a wonderful collection. I know there are always far more options than I could ever use, so I'm careful and selective in my process. And I'm very selective. I often have to do a lot of extra work to contact an artist, get their permission to use one of their art pieces, then have it printed on special material so that it looks good in our semi-outdoor desert gallery. But it's worth it in the end, because we feature some of the best visionary art in the world, and when it's all displayed, it creates an unforgettable impression on our guests. I believe it's important to import this curation mindset into your pursuit of opportunity in life. Remember, you're not selecting opportunities in isolation, and you're not going to have only one chance at selecting an opportunity. You have essentially unlimited choice available to you, and you will be selecting opportunities as a way of life into the future. So start thinking about how to curate a system for curating those that are the very... As you select great opportunities in life, you will build a collection of them, and some will start to pay off in wonderful ways. You will start seeing how the right combination of successes in life brings you something higher and more interesting than just winning once in one domain. As an opportunity curator, you'll build a collection of wonderful opportunities in different domains of life. You'll look for opportunities to become more healthy and energetic. You'll create opportunities to build relationships with people you admire. You'll pursue opportunities to create meaning in your life. You'll collaborate with others on opportunities to live your purpose and make a contribution in the world. As all these begin working together as a part of one life, you'll see how they synergize and create a higher order emergent success that cannot be achieved by succeeding in one area alone. To embrace the curation mindset and to begin approaching reality as an intentional and conscious curator, you must transcend or go beyond the mindset of just deciding. You must see that each decision is actually a choice and that you have lots of options. If you ever feel like you have no choice and your decision is being made for you, take a time out and ask yourself if this is really true. Sure, once in a while you'll find yourself without options or choice, but this is the kind of thing that we just don't have to deal with most of the time in life. Use the tools that you're learning to generate lots of opportunities so that you always have options. Next, when you face a situation where you feel pressured to decide or feel stressed because you know the decision that you're about to make has big implications for your life, take a few breaths, put it in a wider perspective or bigger context, and see that your life is a progression of steps and that this choice is one of many. Most of the choices we make in life are not life or death, and many of them can be made by using the tools we're learning here. If you remember to use a multi-model approach, you can make great progress. Ultimately, what we're learning about here is moving up a level and approaching opportunity as a curator. You're creating a gallery of opportunity in your life, and you want to walk in, look around, and see that you have many choices, several of which are potentially great for you. When you start designing your life in this way, it can give you back a lot of energy unconsciously wasted worrying about decisions, and it frees up our attention for more important things. We're not deciding, we're choosing. And we're not just choosing, we're curating. If you don't have enough great options to curate, then take a time out. Go add good options to the mix so that you're choosing and selecting, not deciding. Then, from those options that you generate yourself, select a promising mix of them to seriously consider. Curate your opportunities. Curate your life. Wait, wait, wait. Commit. Money burns a hole in my pocket. I'm not sure if this is because I grew up poor and there was never enough money around, or if it's just the way I am, or maybe it's the culture I grew up in, or maybe a combination. In any event, I have a hard time just sitting on money and not using it. When I was younger, I carried credit card debt for many years. In my early 30s, I had about $30,000 worth of credit card debt. Fortunately, I had invested a lot of this money in books, seminars, and education, but it was still there. And a lot of it, to be honest, was because I couldn't stop myself from spending the money. I've met a lot of other people who have a similar problem with money. Part of the problem, I now believe, is that we forget that better and better opportunities are coming in the future. So we take whatever is available in the moment. Probably another tendency left over from our prehistoric foraging days. If you have resources, you have to use them, or they'll go bad or be taken by someone else. Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger are very impressive, not only in their success, but also in their patience. I've already mentioned that they will sit on a huge pile of cash for years if they don't have a wonderful opportunity to invest in. Their mindset is wait, 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 commit. They are looking for one good investment idea per year. Often they don't find one, so they hold on to billions of dollars in cash waiting for just the right opportunity to come along. This might sound like a paradox, or possibly like it doesn't go along with some of the other things that I'm saying here in this book. If there are lots of opportunities around and more coming in the future, why not just invest your resources in the best of what's available? This is where a bit of artistry is needed. Yes, there are lots of opportunities around us right now, and yes, there are exponentially more coming in the future. But striking the balance between acting now and waiting for just the right opportunity for you is important. Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger invest in the long term. They think in decades and lifetimes. When you start looking at the implications of compounding interest, capital gains, and long-term accumulation, you see just how important it is to choose the best opportunities possible. After 15 years of making investments, if I had to do it all over again, I would have made half as many investments, held on to the cash I had, and waited for better opportunities to come along. I would have waited years in some cases. If you have to figure out how to hide the money from yourself, do it. I'm half kidding here, but save up your capital and wait for those great investments, seriously. Warren and Charlie often mention that it's not just the waiting, but it's also the courage and nerve to make a decision and commit when you see the right opportunity. This combination of patience plus action when you discover the right opportunity is a winning long-term strategy. Another benefit to this approach is that it encourages study and research. It incentivizes you to really understand the investments that you're looking at. Warren Buffett recommends not to invest in things that you don't understand. This is one of the best pieces of investing advice that I've ever received. If you're going to be betting a lot, you want to be as sure as possible that your investment has a high probability of paying off. And the surest way to know this is to understand what you're investing in. But overall, remember the mantra, wait, 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 commit. How many haps will this opportunity give you? When you're selecting an opportunity, it's important to calculate not only the financial return, but also the personal return that you're going to potentially receive, as well as the personal price of being involved with the opportunity. Opportunities will come and go. You'll win some and you'll lose some. And while the chances are that a particular opportunity isn't going to be the one that changes everything for you, some opportunities can cause you to become stressed, depressed, or very unfulfilled. I'd like to propose that you estimate the potential of any particular opportunity using what I call holistic actualization points, or HAPS for short. It's a score that you personally estimate between 1 and 10 that is an approximation of how much this opportunity will contribute to your overall long-term personal actualization. If an opportunity doesn't contribute to the quality of your life and to your own personal growth, then is it really an opportunity? If it's going to drag you down or become an emotional burden, is it something that you really want for yourself? My wife uses the term HAPS to mean happy. She says, that gives me the HAPS when she's really happy about something. Because we're talking about the dimension of actualization and fulfillment, I felt that this was a wonderful feeling to incorporate into the term. If the opportunity is to start a new business that might make you $1 million, but it's doing something that you will hate for the next 10 years in order to get there, and it won't grow you very much, then it's probably a 1 or 2 on the HAPS scale. But if the opportunity is to join a new mastermind that you'll be paying to be a member of and travel to 3 times per year that will help you become a better parent, and you have a strong intuition that this is going to make you and your family stronger, then it might be a 7 or 8 on the HAPS scale. Note that the first example might make you $1 million, and the second example would cost you money and time. But the second one will bring you so much more fulfillment and actualization in the long run. I have seen many people get involved in opportunities just because they thought that it would make them money, but who wound up feeling trapped and unhappy with the reality of their situation. They knew going in that they were doing it just for the money, but they didn't really take time to calculate the cost to their esteem and to their spirit. Another reason to consider giving each opportunity you encounter a HAPS score between 1 and 10 is that the opportunities that we are going to encounter in the future are going to become more diverse. We will encounter more and more opportunities to develop our health, our emotional resilience, our business, to travel, to build diverse relationships, and to learn knowledge, to find our purpose, to contribute, to evolve spiritually. And when we discover these opportunities, we will likely have to compare very different opportunities in order to decide where to place our attention and invest our time. How do you compare an opportunity to take up a new exercise routine that will take 30 minutes per day, but give you more health and energy, with an opportunity to join a new men's or women's group that will provide you with emotional support and create an environment that will grow you spiritually? How do you compare an opportunity to invest $10,000 into the stock market versus the $10,000 into an education program that will help you launch and grow your own business? How do you compare an opportunity to do something that will improve your relationship with your children to an opportunity that will provide your family with a nicer place to live? These are complex decisions, and they are typically stressful. Many people will just shut down when faced with big decisions that have implications this wide and deep in their lives. Others will get so excited about one new opportunity that they won't consider the opportunity cost or take the time to look at the other things that they could be using their time, energy, attention, and resources to invest in. By considering the long-term implications of an opportunity and how that will contribute to your own personal growth and actualization, then giving it a HAPS score, you have a simple, intuitive way to score one opportunity against another. Someone approached me recently with an opportunity to invest in and advise a technology startup. The entrepreneur is smart and the business idea is solid. As I considered the investment and a role in the business, I realized that it wasn't something that would challenge me, as I've done several things like this in the past. It wouldn't grow me very much as a person or as an investor, even if it made me a lot of money. It would probably have a HAPS score of about 3 or 4 in the long run. And that's not enough to get my attention right now in my life. My wife and I have been discussing teaching a series of classes on romantic relationships, intimacy, collaboration, and conflict resolution. The more we discuss it, the more I see how valuable the material would be to others, and the more I believe that this would challenge my wife and me to go to the next level in our own relationship. I don't know if it would be financially successful because I don't know if the way we think about relationships would resonate with a wider audience. But the personal and relationship growth alone would probably give me a HAPS score of 8 or 9. So this is something we're going to do soon. As you consider an opportunity, don't let excitement blind you to the wider implications of your involvement with it. Always ask yourself, how much will this contribute to my overall actualization as a person and as a success in the world? If getting involved with this opportunity will lead to a lot of personal growth and development, then score it higher on the HAPS scale and include that in your calculation of the value of the opportunity. Again, you're looking for opportunities that will deliver a high level of holistic actualization points, HAP, HAPS, in the long run of your life. If it's going to be a drag on your enthusiasm and your spirit, then be very careful. Very rarely is it worth it to do something just for the money, fame, success, or power if it's going to cost you your happiness and self-esteem. Another way to use the HAPS score is to calculate how many HAPS you will lose in a particular domain if you commit to a particular opportunity. If you have the prospect of starting a new business, consider how it will impact the other areas of your life. Right now, I have a daughter who's going to be turning 5 years old soon. Writing this book, along with other business projects, has taken a lot of intensive time and effort, and I haven't seen her as much as I would have liked over the past few months. Not spending as much time with her has cost me HAPS in that domain of my life. Overall, I feel the investment is worth it, but by feeling the cost to my emotions and my conscience, I am fine-tuning my sense of what an opportunity will mean in my life. In the future, I will likely not take on as much as I have lately because it's important to me to have more time available to spend with my wife and my family. Remember the question, on a scale of 1 to 10, how many haps will this bring me? Checking in with all levels of your being. When you are on the verge of actually making a choice and selecting an opportunity for your opportunity portfolio, take a moment to check in with the different levels of your being. As you're making your decision about which opportunity to take on, check in with yourself at these three levels. Instinctive check. This is checking in with your gut. Make sure you are in a calm and relaxed environment, close your eyes, and take a deep breath. Feel down in your stomach and in the core of your body. Does this opportunity feel right? If so, your body will expand in response to the question rather than contract. Use your body's openness or closedness as the indicator of an intuitive yes or no. There are an estimated 100 million brain cells in the gut, and many believe this provides us with the gut sense that most of us have. By checking with your gut, you check in with an ancient sense of personal wisdom. Integrity check. This is a check that makes sure the opportunity is aligned with the rest of your core values. I define personal integrity as the alignment of thought, feeling, and action. Ask yourself, does this opportunity align with my life, my values, and how I want to feel? The real implications of most opportunities don't reveal themselves until you're deep into the project. Search your intuition to ensure your values are in alignment with the opportunity you are considering. Higher self check. Each of us has a latent higher self, a conscience, or something like a superego. If you don't relate to these terms or ideas, then just try imagining a more actualized future version of yourself. Try to get in contact with the more transcendent aspect of your consciousness and move your perspective and identity to that place. Once you're in touch with that aspect of yourself, ask from there, does this opportunity support my highest self and the transcendent values that I stand for? In his book Flow, the psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi draws a distinction between the idea of happiness and the concept of joy or enjoyment. He describes joy as a more encompassing long-term fulfillment in life. The experience of enjoyment typically includes some happiness, although not always. You can enjoy something that is even frustrating, as long as it is also so interesting it keeps you fully engaged. What we're after are opportunities that put us into the flow state as we pursue them. This leads to a deeper engagement that develops our intelligence and creative spirit. As you're tuning into these levels of your intuition, remember you want to choose an opportunity that's going to be great for you as a person, as an individual, as a family member, and at the soul or spirit level. An opportunity to make twice the money but have half the joy in life isn't usually worth it. Marie Kondo recommends going through your home or office and touching each item, then asking the simple question, does this bring me joy? If it does, keep it. If not, then get rid of it. Your joy is important. I did a series of counseling sessions with Dr. Nathaniel Brandon, the man considered the father of the idea of self-esteem. In the first session, he asked me questions about what I was trying to do in my life. I answered by explaining how the different projects I was working on would contribute to others and help the world. After listening to me for a while, he asked, "But what about you? What about you being happy?" This led me down a path of consideration that has been fruitful in the development of my own joy in life. In his work, Dr. Brandon defines self-esteem as the feeling of confidence that you can cope with the challenges that come up in life, plus your feeling of deserving happiness. Just as evolution is composed of adaptation plus selection, self-esteem is composed of confidence plus deserving happiness. You need both if you want to have a fulfilling life. The key here is to avoid unconsciously undermining your trust and confidence in yourself by choosing opportunities which are at odds with your values. This will only create friction later in your life. To put it another way, don't sabotage your future self. Instead, make choices that grow your sense of confidence about being able to handle the challenges that will come, along with your feeling of deserving happiness. Opportunity negotiation. When I was in my late teens, I would often buy and sell secondhand guitars and musical equipment. I would look for bargains and then fix or clean them up to use or sell or trade later. Even though most things I bought were in the tens or maybe hundreds of dollars, I noticed patterns. One thing I realized was that if I was buying a guitar for $100 and was able to negotiate $20 off the price in the last few minutes, that I was effectively making hundreds of dollars per hour during that little window. If it took me 5 extra minutes to save $20, I was making $4 per minute, which is $240 per hour. At that point in my life, I was earning in the range of about $6 per hour at my job, so saving $20 was like getting back over 3 hours of my time for free. If I could save $100, it was getting back a couple of days of my life. I eventually developed a little system and script that I would use when buying things. I haven't thought about this in years, but as I sit here writing, it's coming back to me just how powerful this script was. Here are the 3 questions I would use. 1. How flexible are you on your price? 2. What's your best price right now? 3. Would you take $100 in cash as I held out the money? Let's say that I was at a garage sale looking at a set of speakers that I wanted to buy. Maybe the speakers had a sticker on them that said the price was $200. I would decide how much I wanted to pay for them and then prepare the cash in one pocket of my pants. We'll assume for this example that I was willing to pay $100 for the speakers. I would then put $100 in one pocket so it was ready to go. Once I was ready, I would say to the owner that I had a question about the speakers. If I had any specific question about the condition or the functionality, I would ask those first. Then when I was ready, I would say, "How flexible are you on your price?" This indicated that I was interested, but also that I was going to negotiate. It's an open question, and often a seller would say something like, "I'm pretty flexible and I'll make you a good deal," or something similar. If this happened, I might know to offer even less than what I was first thinking. If the answer was not very flexible, I think this is worth it and I'm pretty firm on my price, I would continue to the next step. I would ask, "What's your best price right now?" This would send the message that I'm serious and ready to buy now. We're talking about money and getting to specifics. Again, if they suggested in some way that they would accept a price that was lower than I had already decided I'd pay, I would often offer even less to see if I could get a better bargain. If they said, "I'd take $50 for those speakers if you want them," then I might say, "Would you take $25?" At this point, it's obvious that I'm going to buy them, so it didn't hurt to ask. Sometimes a seller would just want to get rid of something and they would almost give it away. But let's say that the owner of the speakers looked at them and said, "I'm asking $200 and the lowest I'd go is $150. Then I was ready with my final offer. I would take out the $100 in cash, fan it out so they can see that it was $100 total, hold it out to them and say, "Would you take $100 in cash?" There's something about having the money right in front of you that is very persuasive. And many times, a person selling an old pair of speakers that they didn't care about would take the money and say, "You have a deal." 10 years or so later, when I was in my late 20s and learning how to meet girls, I developed a similar approach. At this point in life, I had no idea how to start a conversation with a woman or what to say if I was having one. Women seemed like aliens to me, and the process of meeting a woman was a complete mystery. As I made friends with a diverse group of men who had more natural intuition and skill around women, I had several major revelations. One of them came from watching men start conversations with women they didn't know and then get a phone number or contact information within a few minutes. That looked like magic to me, so I continued investigating until I figured out what was happening, and I was able to replicate it myself. What's interesting is that the process often involved a bit of negotiation. Let's say I was talking to a woman at a bar on a Friday night. Maybe we met standing in line or ordering a drink. After a few minutes of conversation, I might go back to talking with my friends. Before I left, I would say, "Hey, do you have email?" If she said yes, then I would take out a pen and piece of paper and say, "Here, write it down for me." Most of the time, if the conversation was going well, she'd write down her email. I started by asking for something that was low risk to give to me. Then, while she was writing her email, I'd say, "And write your number there too." Many times, she would just keep writing, and I'd leave with a name, email, and phone number all in a few minutes. But sometimes a woman would stop, look at me, and say, "I don't even know you." To which I would respond, "It's okay. You can give me your number. I'll only call you 10 times a day." This would typically get a laugh, and then a written phone number. Sometimes the banter would continue on for a minute or two, with me continuing to tell her that it was going to be fine to give me her number, but only if she agreed not to call me all the time once she had mine when I called, and continuing to joke around. She might want to connect via social or send me a text or sometimes take my number or contact info instead. But I learned through experience that I often had to negotiate to get a woman to give me her contact information. And I also had to be ready. I bought a wallet that had a pen built in so that I was always carrying something to write with. This in itself was kind of interesting because the pen I had was a conversation piece in itself, a space pen, which comes in all kinds of colors and finishes. These examples might seem small and relatively insignificant at first glance, but each of them represents me going through a particular type of situation over and over in life and realizing something important. If I was ready in the moment to negotiate, I could create a much more favorable outcome for myself. I am fascinated by watching people miss opportunities in their lives. It's not something I enjoy, but it's kind of like watching a car crash. You can't look away. It's painful, but you can learn a lot. Most of the time, when a person wants something for themselves, but they don't go after it, then persist until they get it, and negotiate to get the best deal possible, it appears to me that it's fundamentally a self-image and self-esteem issue. They didn't grow up learning that they deserve to have what they want in life, and they didn't develop the skill and ability to actually get the things that they want. Neurolinguistic programming has an interesting maxim. Possible in the world and possible for me is a matter of how. This essentially means that if it's possible for one person to do something, then anyone can do it if they learn how. I like this general approach to life, and most of the time you'll find that believing this will help you learn and achieve at a much higher level. Sometimes what's possible for one person or group isn't possible for others because that person or group has a special advantage or unique genius that you don't have. But if you generally believe that anything is possible for you, and you seek to learn how those that are best do it, you can almost always make great progress and enjoy many of the benefits of success that the best enjoy. In this case, we're discussing the topic of negotiation, and I would like to suggest to you that it's worth it to pay careful attention to the moments in life when you are making a deal or setting up a transaction. In those often brief windows of time, there's an exponential multiplication in the benefit and return that you can receive on your effort and investment. If you typically make $50 per hour in your life and you're negotiating the salary for your next job, you might make an additional $5,000 in yearly pay by negotiating for another hour in the right way. This is a 100x increase in your typical hourly income, and it's a very big deal to take it when the window of opportunity is open for you. As you begin using the mindsets and tools in this book to increase the quality and quantity of opportunities in your life, keep an eye out for those special high-leverage moments. Prepare yourself to discuss price and terms and to negotiate for what you want in the agreement. If you're negotiating to hire someone or to go to work for a company or to collaborate or partner with someone, there are more reasons than just money to do this. If you don't negotiate a deal that really works for you in terms of time, money, working relationship, and expectations, you can quickly find yourself unhappy, unfulfilled, or even feeling taken advantage of. If you get to this place, it's likely that you didn't carefully consider what you wanted and needed, and you missed your opportunity to negotiate and ask for it up front. If you are interviewing someone and want to hire them for your company, ask them if they'll come to work part-time for a couple of months to do a project as a consultant or contractor. This gives you a real live experiential impression of how the person behaves in actual working situations, and it can sometimes save you a lot of time and money by seeing actual performance rather than just hearing talk of performance. If you're negotiating for a service or buying media, ask what the price is if you buy a lot more than you want right now. Indicate that if what you're testing out with them works, you would like to scale up in the future, if it's true, of course. Often, a company will give you a better rate up front if they believe that you could become a bigger purchaser down the road, and using this to negotiate up front has both saved me and made me a lot of money. In real estate, they say, you make the money when you buy, not when you sell. This means that your profit will be determined by the price you negotiate when you purchase, not the price you negotiate when you liquidate. If you can save $10,000 by negotiating for another day or two, was that worth it? One of my cousins has built up a portfolio of rental homes over the past few decades. He told me something maybe 20 years ago or so that stuck with me. He said that if you call up 10 people who are advertising their homes for sale by owner, and you ask each of them if they'll take 20% less than their asking price if you pay cash, one of them will probably say yes. It's an interesting way to start a conversation, isn't it? Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger have a philosophy when it comes to buying companies. Warren says that he used to look for good businesses at wonderful prices, but then Charlie came along and convinced him to buy wonderful businesses at good prices. If you're buying the best, you don't need to always negotiate bargain basement prices. A good price is good enough. But if you read into this, you can still see that there's a spirit of negotiation in there. Wonderful businesses at good prices. As I move through my life, I really see the wisdom in waiting for the best and in buying one great thing rather than a bunch of just okay things. As you practice negotiation in different domains of life, you will eventually see a pattern that some call the wanting it tax. If you want something too much, to the point where it becomes obvious that you are needy or desperate, the price goes up dramatically. We could probably spend an entire book on a topic like this one, as it involves more general animal drives and status dynamics, plus a lot of psychology. But for now, it's useful to mention that if you're about to initiate a transaction, make an offer, or negotiate a deal, get yourself to the point mentally and emotionally where you don't need the thing that you're acting to get. Look at other options. Create other ways to do it in your mind. Figure out alternative approaches to achieve your outcome. And demonstrate to the other person or people that you're interacting with that you are stable and self-sufficient. In negotiation, there's a famous phrase, negotiate with one hand on the door, meaning to always be acting like you're about to leave the negotiation in order to convince the other person that you have other options and might walk away. This is going a bit too far as I'm concerned, but it's worth remembering as a concept because negotiating with one hand on the door also results in you not having to pay the wanting it tax. I'd like to also clarify something here. When I talk about being ready for the moment of striking an agreement or asking someone to do something, I'm not suggesting to take advantage of another person's situation or weakness and to profit at their expense. If I'm buying a pair of speakers from someone at a garage sale and offering them $100 less than they're asking, I'm not putting them into a compromising position or financial situation. If I'm asking a woman for her phone number and then joking around with her to convince her to give it to me, I don't lie and say that I want to cast her in a movie and make her a star. Don't take advantage of people who are in unfortunate situations or lie in order to get a better deal in life. Negotiate in good faith and play the game in a fair way. I've been studying marketing for many years, and I use powerful persuasion and influence techniques when I create my sales letters and videos. I really believe in the tools and training that I offer people, and I've invested years to create programs that will change the life of anyone that goes through them. This gives me a lot of confidence to pitch my products. But I don't actively target people who are in financial hardship and promise to make them rich with the push of a button. I don't go looking for people who are desperate and convince them that all of their problems will be solved if they just give me the last of their money. It was Napoleon Hill in his book Think and Grow Rich who introduced me to this poem. I bargained with life for a penny, and life would pay me no more. However, I begged at evening when I counted my scanty store. For life is just an employer. He gives you what you ask. But once you have set the wages, why, you must bear the task. I worked for a menial's hire, only to learn, dismayed, that any wage I had asked of life, life would have paid. Jesse B. Rittenhouse. If you prepare yourself for the moments of negotiation in life, you can bargain for a lot more. And if you do this over weeks, months, years, and decades of your life, the compounded gains really start multiplying and adding up. The windows of opportunity that open at negotiation points can be some of the biggest that you encounter in life. Be ready. Reminder, get a summary of this entire book, plus written implementation exercises for every chapter, additional bonus sections, and access to a free class to help you discover your best opportunities by visiting opportunitybonus.com. Opportunity selection and negotiation. To choose one opportunity, you must cut off all of the others. Decisions like this can be stressful because at some point you are aware of the potential mistake or loss. Evolution is about both adaptation and selection. Selecting your best opportunities is a key to survival and evolutionary success. Because there are so many more options and opportunities in life, we would be wise to take a curation approach. You are building a collection of opportunities over your personal and business life. Use the strategy that Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger use. Wait, wait, wait. Commit. When comparing opportunities from very different domains in life, we need a common currency to use in order to compare them. Use the HAPS approach to quickly get a sense of which opportunity will be most helpful in your own personal growth and actualization. Check in with all levels of your being before making a decision about an opportunity. Negotiation is a very high-value activity relative to opportunity. You can multiply your typical earning power 10x to 100x or more by negotiating with focus and skill. Where do you notice feeling stress when choosing or making decisions about opportunities? What are the opportunities that you're currently experiencing and creating in your life, and what is the HAPS score for each of them? How could you negotiate a better deal on an opportunity that you're going to commit to soon?